Legend of Yue Fei, Chapter 17.
The story just plunges us right into this period of intense conflict. You've got the Jin army pushing hard into Song territory, and the mood. It's set straight away by this powerful poem. It talks about great cannons roaring like thunder and, you know, the grim reality that even the best heroes can fall, really emphasizes the stakes.
Yeah, what's fascinating is how the source just throws you into the chaos immediately.
Right.
No holding back. We're talking about a fierce siege, specifically at Lianglang Pass, a really crucial strategic point. The stage is definitely set for a very dramatic high-stakes showdown.
And right at the center of all this, our main figure, Madame Liang Hongyu. She's known as the Grand Marshal of Lianglang Pass. The text tells us she's just received, well, utterly devastating news. Her husband, Marshal Han, and her older son. They're believed to be badly wounded, or maybe even worse.
Mm. And that really brings up a profound question, doesn't it? About leadership, about resilience. What do you do when you're facing that kind of personal tragedy right in the middle of a huge military crisis?
So what does the narrative say she does?
Well, her immediate reaction isn't despair. It's not retreat. It's this fierce, almost gut-level desire for vengeance. Her generals are advising her to play defense, you know, hold the pass. But she makes this critical, defiant call. She's going to lead an attack herself.
Wow.
Yeah. And before she rides out, she arranges for her youngest son to be taken care of by a wet nurse couple for his safety. That says a lot, I think, about her resolve, but also her foresight, even in that moment.
So she's definitely not just charging in blindly. She's thinking strategically. And this is where her military mind really shows, right? She orders these iron carts, which sound like maybe mobile defensive weapons.
Seems likely, yeah.
Yeah.
Probably mobile siege engines, maybe defensive, maybe even for counterattack.
And she orders those great cannons to be set up specifically at Three Mountain Pass. So yeah, not just a grieving wife or a panicked general. She's got a clear, calculated plan.
Exactly. It's not just bravery, it's strategy. Positioning those carts and cannons there, it suggests she's not just going out to fight. She's maybe laying a trap, anticipating Wu Zi will pursue her, planning a potentially devastating counter move. It really highlights her skill as a commander, even under extreme pressure.
That strategic thinking leads right into what happens next, doesn't it? Madame Liang rides out, confronts the enemy general directly, face to face. And who is it? It's none other than Wu Zi, the fourth prince of the Great Jin Kingdom, Grand Marshal for sweeping the South, a major figure.
Oh, absolutely a big name.
And apparently he's even heard of her, knows her reputation as a skilled commander.
And if you look at the bigger picture, this isn't just like a personal duel. It's really symbolic. It represents the clash between the Song and the Jin forces as a whole.
Right.
And Wu Zi, he tries to break her spirit without fighting. You know, he offers her life, rank, if she surrenders. He even claims her husband and son are just captured. A clear psychological play.
But Madame Liang, she's having absolutely none of it. She believes her family's dead. She's furious. He's trying to trick her. She basically curses him out and attacks her saber against his axe.
Mm.
The text says they fight for, what, 5 or 6 rounds? But ultimately, she cannot hold her own. She's forced back.
Right. She has to retreat towards the pass. It's a desperate defense at this point.
And as Wu Zi chases her right up to the gates of Lianglang Pass, she yells the order, "Fire the cannons!" But what happens next is, well, it's completely unexpected. Almost supernatural, really.
Yeah, it is.
Suddenly, the sky just goes black with fog, and there's this massive clap of thunder.
This is the turning point. A classic example in this kind of narrative of heaven's will stepping in. The text is very specific. It says the Nine Ox Grand General Cannon, this huge, powerful cannon meant to defend the pass, gets hit directly by lightning.
Right.
And it explodes violently.
Wow.
But, and this is crucial, it explodes inward, blasting Lianglang Pass wide open.
Unbelievable. Talk about a reversal of fortune.
Completely. A shocking twist.
The source even has this dramatic name for it. Thunder shakes three mountains, cannon blasts Lianglang Pass. So poetic, almost.
It really captures the chaos, doesn't it?
Totally. Wu Zi's forces just pour into the pass now that it's open. And Madame Liang, she's devastated. She sees the pass is lost. Her iron carts are now useless.
She has no choice left.
Life, she has to flee.
Now, while all this drama is unfolding at the pass, what about Marshal Han, Madame Liang's husband?
Right. What's happening with him?
Well, he's been fighting somewhere else in the Jin camp. And he starts noticing the enemy forces thinning out around him. They're getting distracted, probably by the news that Lianglang Pass has suddenly fallen.
Okay.
And then he spots him, his elder son, alive, but being chased by a Jin general.
Wow, so a parallel desperate moment, just like Madame Liang was fighting for the past.
Exactly. Marshal Ham is now fighting for his son's life. He rushes in, tries to intervene. He strikes the Jin general's helmet with his sword. But then something really strange happens. This white light erupts from the general's head, and it somehow stops the sword, prevents it from cutting him. Almost magical.
A white light. Okay, that's weird. Who is this general?
And here it is, the big reveal, the historical aha moment, as you called it earlier. The text tells us this mysterious Jin general is Qiuwen Temujin.
Temujin. Wait,
Yes. The novel is basically dropping this huge hint. This is the future Genghis Khan.
no way.
Way. And the white light. The text suggests it's because he's destined for greatness. He's the ancestor of Kublai Khan, the one who will found the Yuan dynasty and completely change the map.
So that little detail, that failed sword strike, it's packed with this immense, like, cosmic significance, foreshadowing everything.
Exactly. It's a really powerful narrative device, isn't it? It subtly suggests that, maybe even the greatest warriors can't really stop the predetermined course of history, especially when fate has marked someone for such huge future power.
Incredible. So Marshal Han and his son, they see this weird light. They manage to escape the chaos. They see the Jin flags now flying over Liang Lang Pass, so they flee too.
Right. They head into a dense forest for cover. And there, by just an amazing stroke of luck, Madame Liang and their youngest son, the one she sent away, they're already there, sheltering.
Oh, wow. So they're reunited.
Yes. The whole family reunited amidst the chaos and defeat. It's actually a deeply emotional moment in the text. Brings this very human touch right after the huge battle and the supernatural event.
And Madame Liang explains what happened, the thunder, the cannon.
She does. And Marshal Han, he listens and he understands this wasn't just a military blunder. It was something else. He basically says, this is heaven's will, not something human power can undo. Just accepting the inexplicable.
Acceptance, even after such a massive loss.
Mm.
So with the pass gone, the battle lost, what do they decide?
They decide to head for the capital, beyond Liang, to wait for further orders from the emperor.
The Jin forces, they're riding high. They just smashed through and took Liang Lang Pass. Big win.
Huge win.
Their leader, Wu Zu, he enters the pass, but the first thing that grabs his eye isn't, the fortifications or anything. It's this thing called an iron cart.
Ah, yes.
And he's immediately curious, turns to his military advisor, like, hey, who built this?
Now, what's fascinating here is the advisor's response. He doesn't just say, oh, the Song built it. No, he immediately brings up Han Xin and Xiang Yu.
The Han Dynasty strategist and the overlord, that's quite a reference.
It really is. It's not just history. It feels like psychological warfare almost.
Mm.
By linking Wuzu's victory to Han Xin trapping Xiang Yu, he's basically saying, you're like Han Xin, destined for greatness.
Ah, okay. So it elevates the victory.
Totally. It frames it as heavenly protection, boundless good fortune. It's spinning this narrative that the Jin are unstoppable, maybe even destined to rule, great for morale.
Right, that makes sense. Fueling that momentum. So, with that psychological boost, what's Wuzu's next move, strategically speaking?
Well, he doesn't waste time. The plan is pretty straightforward. Gather supplies right there, then push hard towards Heijian Prefecture.
Okay.
And after Heijian, the big prize, cross the Yellow River. Wuzu starts seeing the capture of Bianqing, the Song capital, as, well, almost imminent, like maybe just days away.
Wow, so really aggressive. He feels unstoppable.
Pretty much. The path seems clear to him.
So while Wuzu's planning this final push towards the capital, Blanjing, what's happening on the Song side? Losing Liangling Pass must have caused, well, chaos.
Oh, absolutely. The fallout is immediate and frankly brutal. You've got Han Xizong, a really famous general, and his wife. They meet an imperial envoy, and bam, a decree strips them of their positions, sends them packing back to Shaanxi.
Just like that, ouch.
Yeah, their past service saved their lives, apparently, but their careers over, reputation shattered.
So what does this signal? Is it just punishing failure?
It's partly that, but it's also about responsibility, isn't it? Losing a key spot like Lianglang Pass, someone has to pay the price, even a decorated general. It's a stark warning to everyone else.
A tough system. So this raises an important question about that weight of responsibility, even if circumstances were impossible.
Exactly. And it definitely puts the fear into other commanders.
Which brings us neatly to Zheng Xuye. He's the governor of Heijian Prefecture, the place Wuzu is heading for next.
Right in the path of the storm.
So when he gets the news, Ling Lang Pass is gone, Wuzu's army is coming, you can just imagine his reaction, pure fear.
The source says he's thinking about Lu Deng, who failed before, and now Han Shizhong, disgraced. He's probably thinking, if they couldn't stop him,
what chance do I have? Yeah.
But here's where it gets interesting. Zhang Xue, despite being terrified, comes up with a, well, a rather cunning plan.
Okay. Not just surrender.
No, not a real surrender. He decides on what's called Emerono. Jing Xiang, a feigned surrender.
A fake surrender.
His main goal, it seems, is to protect the people in the city. Avoid a slaughter if the Jin attack directly.
Okay, a delaying tactic.
More than that, it's a long-term strategy. He figures, let Wuzu cross the Yellow River, get deeper into Song territory. Then, when other Song armies engage Wuzu, Zhang Shui plans to rise up, cut off his retreat route, and trap him.
Whoa, that's ambitious and incredibly risky.
Very risky. A high-stakes gamble, really, but driven by trying to save lives.
It's a major ethical dilemma, too, isn't it? Deception to save lives.
Definitely. A heavy burden for a leader.
So while Zhang Shui is wrestling with this huge strategic decision, trying to play this dangerous game, something totally different is happening, much more personal, right inside his own house.
Yes, this is a fantastic turn in the story.
We meet his two sons, Zhang Li and Zhang Yong. And the description paints quite a picture. 10 feet tall. Okay, maybe an exaggeration, but clearly big, imposing guys.
Well, like warriors.
Yeah. Zhang Li has a broad face, big ears. Zhang Yong, a darker complexion. And they both use these heavy iron staffs, apparently with incredible strength.
Not guys you'd want to mess with.
Definitely not. So on this crucial day, they're just waiting for lunch in the study. And it's late. They're getting annoyed, a bit suspicious.
And it's funny, isn't it? This very mundane thing, waiting for lunch, being hungry and irritated.
Yeah.
That's the trigger. That everyday frustration leads them straight into discovering this massive, life-changing secret about their father's plan, just because the food was late.
It's incredible how small things can spark huge events. So the servant boy finally shows up with the food.
About time.
Zhang Yong is ticked off, asks why it's so late, maybe even threatens the kid. And the servant, unbelievably cheeky, basically says, yeah, it's late today, but at least you got food. Soon you might not get any.
Ooh, provocative.
Right. So Zhang Li presses him, what do you mean no food? And then the servant just spills everything.
The whole story.
Pretty much. Tells them Liang Lang Pass is lost, Lun Prefecture 2, the Jin Army is coming, and oh, by the way, your dad is in the hall right now planning to surrender to save the city.
Wow. Delivered just like that. By a servant boy.
Blunt force truth.
And the impact on the sons. It must have been like a physical blow. This raises the question of how unfiltered truth from an unexpected source can just shatter someone's world. They just can't process it. Our father, do that.
Total disbelief. Their immediate reaction is just fury. They can't believe their father would, in their eyes, become a traitor, surrender to the Tartars, as they call them.
It's a complete betrayal from their perspective. Honor is everything.
So they cook up this plan. It's impulsive, incredibly rash.
Not exactly well thought out, I imagine.
Not at all. They decide, ask mom for money, maybe 200 or 300 taels of silver, sneak out of the city, find the Jin army, and fight them.
Just the two of them. Against Wuzu's entire army.
Just the two of them with their iron staffs. And if they get overwhelmed, which seems likely, they'll just flee somewhere else.
That's incredibly brave or incredibly foolish.
Or both. Definitely both. And what's really fascinating, almost heartbreaking, is the conversation with their mother.
Ah, yes. How does that go?
They ask for the silver, and she completely misunderstands. She thinks they just want to buy some supplies, you know, before the Jin arrive and things get chaotic.
I don't know.
So she just gives them 200 taels, easily. Tells them to be careful. She has absolutely no idea they're planning the suicidal charge.
That's, wow, just a poignant moment of a mother's love, completely unaware of the reality. You think she's helping them prepare? They're preparing for battle.
It's rough. So they grab the silver, quickly wolf down their finally arrived food, bundle everything up, open the back garden gate, and slip out of the city.
And head straight for the enemy.
Pretty much. They don't get very far. Maybe 20 or 30 lays out, what's that, six, maybe 9 miles?
Not far at all.
And bam, they run right into the Jin forces. The scale is just overwhelming. The book describes it as like a tide, like waves surging endlessly, a sea of soldiers.
An impossible sight for two men.
You'd think. But what's fascinating here is their reaction. They don't hesitate. They just charge.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Armed only with staffs.
Just their iron staffs. And the impact is immediate and shocking. The source says they're shattering heads, injuring foreheads, just wading into the Jin ranks, causing absolute chaos, killing soldier after soldier.
Unbelievable courage.
Yeah.
Just sheer raw power.
Wu Zhu sees this happening. He sees these two guys just carving through his army, and he's impressed, more than impressed.
He must be.
He actually tells his officers, don't harm them, capture them alive. He recognizes there's something extraordinary about these two brothers. He wants them.
That's quite a testament to their fighting prowess.
Yeah.
So the battle continues.
Oh, yeah. Fiercely. It goes on all day, right until dusk. Eventually, Zhang Li realizes his brother, Zhang Yung, isn't with him anymore. He's surrounded.
How does he get out?
He uses this massive sweeping blow with his staff. The text calls it a sweeping blow to the head. It just clears a path through the soldiers encircling him. And under the cover of the growing darkness, using his strength, he breaks free and escapes.
Wow. And Zhang Yung?
He apparently did something similar. Also broke through the encirclement and managed to flee separately in the chaos. The source just briefly notes they were separated then and wouldn't actually meet again until much later, when they eventually link up with Marshal Yufei and another hero, He Wangqing. The Jin army, they're marching towards the city of Hejian. Everyone's expecting this awful, bloody siege. The tension must have been incredible. And then something totally unexpected happens. Picture this. A Song general, Zhang Shuye, just walks up to Wu Zhu's camp.
Right.
He's carrying a surrender banner, declaring submission. Looks like game over for Hejian, right?
On the surface, yes. But this is where it gets really interesting, strategically. Wu Zhu, he's no fool. He's immediately suspicious. He actually turns to his advisor, Hamichi, and asks, you know, is this guy legit, loyal, or treacherous?
Okay. And what does Hamichi say?
Hamichi confirms Wu Zhu's reputation. He's known everywhere as the first loyal minister.
Ah, so that makes a real surrender seem unlikely.
Exactly. It immediately puts Wu Zhu on edge. Why would the most loyal guy surrender?
So Zhang Shui has to overcome that skepticism. How does he do it? His argument must have been good.
Oh, it was incredibly persuasive. He tells Wu Zhu the Song court is basically falling apart. Riddled with treacherous ministers, he says. Loyal guys like him, they're being pushed out, demoted, and exiled.
And he backs this up?
Yes, he points to facts on the ground. Luoneru Prefecture just fell, a really key spot. Lianlang Pass, another vital defense, gone. He basically says, look, my forces are tiny, meager. How can we possibly resist you?
He's painting a picture of utter hopelessness.
Precisely. But here's the core of his plea and what makes it fascinating. He insists, I'm not doing this for myself. No titles and emoluments, as the text says.
Right.
He frames it entirely as trying to save the people of the entire prefecture from being slaughtered.
So he's not appealing to Wuzhu's ambition, but his ego, his desire for an easy win.
Exactly. It's less about cowardice, more about, you know, this deep humanitarian concern, which of course plays right into Wuzhu's desire for a smooth conquest. It's psychologically brilliant.
And Wu Zhu actually falls for it.
Completely. It's astonishing. He declares Song Shue a good man. Someone who gets heaven's will, has a benevolent heart. Can you believe it?
Wow. So what does Wu Zhu do? Just accept the surrender?
He does much more than that. He gives Song Shue the title King of Lu. Lets him keep control of Hejian.
He lets him keep the city.
Yes. And then commands his own huge army. They can accept provisions from the city, fine, but they have to bypass it. Completely.
No way.
Oh, yes. And he makes this dire threat. Any of his soldiers caught entering Hejian will be beheaded for public display.
That is incredible. So Zhang Shuye pulled it off.
He absolutely did. If you connect this to the bigger picture, this isn't just, you know, saving one city. It's a brilliant tactical move. It's strategic deception on a grand scale. He preserved his city, his people, and he bought the Song dynasty precious time. Reshaped the immediate front line, really.
So the deal is done. Zhang Shuye provides the food. Wuzhu's army marches past Hejian, and they set up camp down by the Yellow River mouth, starting to build boats to cross. Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, because now the news travels, right? Back to the capital.
Exactly. Shifts the scene.
News reaches the Song capital, Emperor Qinzhong. He finds out the Jin army, this massive force, over 500,000 strong, is already near the Yellow River, and he's greatly alarmed. I mean, who wouldn't be?
Understandably. Total panic.
Yeah.
His immediate reaction is to turn to his ministers. Okay, he asks, what strategy do we have? How do we stop them? You just feel the desperation.
And this is where a character named Zheng Bangcheng steps up. Our sources label him a treacherous minister.
Right. Not a good sign.
And he immediately starts spinning things for the emperor. He mentions Lu Deng's heroic death at Luan, framing it as a loss. He talks about Han Shisong and his wife abandoning Linglong Pass, making it sound like desertion, twisting the narrative. And crucially, he describes Zhang Shui's brilliant move in Hejian as just a simple surrender, no mention of the deception.
And this raises a really important question, doesn't it? Why frame these specific events in this particular way? It's almost designed to demoralize.
It sounds like it. So what's his angle?
Well, Zhang Bongtong uses these examples to paint this incredibly bleak picture. You know, resistance is futile. And then he makes his move. He recommends two officials, Lin Gang and Zhang Zi. Now, these guys are genuinely loyal, genuinely capable. He even says, among all the officials, none compared to Li Gang and Zhang Zi.
Okay, so that sounds good. Like, he's recommending the best men for the job.
Ah, but that's the trap. It's classic court intrigue. He knows they're good, but he's putting them in charge of maybe 50,000 troops against 500,000 Jin soldiers.
He's setting them up to fail?
Exactly. It's a lend a knife to kill strategy. He likely hopes they'll be crushed, eliminating two powerful, loyal rivals without him getting his hands dirty. It's incredibly cynical.
And the emperor?
Yeah.
He goes for it.
Seems like it. Desperate, maybe sees no other option. He approves the recommendation. Li Gang is made Grand Marshal for pacifying the North. Zhang Zi is the vanguard. Their task, lead 50,000 troops, stop the Jin at the Yellow River, a huge, almost impossible ask.
Let's follow Li Gang for a moment. He goes home to prepare. The sources say he's loyal, strategic, wise, but he's mainly a civil official. Not really a battlefield commander by trade. You can imagine he's feeling the pressure and maybe some fear.
Oh, absolutely. He's acutely aware of the danger. He knows Zhang Bongchang's recommendation wasn't an honor. It was clearly intended to harm his life. Mm-hmm. It just hammers home how dangerous the internal politics were. The enemy within the gates, you know, almost as scary as the one outside.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Okay, so as Lin Gang is getting ready, there's this interesting little detail. A man shows up at his door. Zhang Bao, described as tall, says he's just doing business, claims he can carry like 500 or 600 Jin, that's a lot of weight over long distances, and Li Gang's wife suggests, hey, bring him along as a servant.
Okay, see, these little details in historical stories, they're often not little at all. Zhang Bao, this strong guy appearing seemingly out of nowhere, feels like more than just a random servant.
Foreshadowing, maybe?
Could be. These narratives rarely include details like that just by chance. Something to keep an eye on.
Right. So then Li Gang meets up with Zhang Zi, and Li Gang is clearly worried. He basically tells Zhang Zi, my life is in your hands. It depends on your protection.
Understandable, given the politics and the military odds.
But Zhang Zi seems much calmer. He reassures him, Marshal, don't worry. Good fortune favors the virtuous. A bit stoic, maybe, but firm.
A sign of his resolve, perhaps?
So they get down to business, gather their 50,000 troops, march to the Yellow River mouth, set up camp. They spread soldiers along the riverbank, and importantly, they collect all the boats they can find onto their side, the south shore.
Smart move. Deny the enemy easy passage. Basic, but crucial.
And then Zhang Zi does something really proactive, something forward-thinking. He sends a messenger telling them to ride day and night to Tangyin County.
Okay, why there?
To find and invite Yu Fei and his brothers to come and help in the battle.
Ah, Yu Fei. Now that's a significant name drop. This is pivotal. It signals that the real heavy hitters, the legendary figures, are starting to enter the stage.